From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. This is episode number 102 and is the first of two parts. You can find the show notes at ketowomanpodcast.com/102. Richard has kindly sorted out the episodes page on the website to make it a list, so it is now way easier to find old episodes. I know this was a pet hate for many of you, so I hope you like the new look. The transcripts page is also now in list format. This week's extraordinary man is Chris Irvin. Chris is a nutrition science researcher and writer with an expertise in ketogenic dieting. He holds a master's degree in exercise and nutrition science and spent his time in graduate school studying the ketogenic diet for performance and therapeutic applications. Chris is the education manager at Perfect Keto and strives to make the ketogenic diet easy and keto science accessible to everyone. I have finally got reasonable internet bandwidth at home. At least I hope so, because it was down again yesterday. And so I will be catching up on some videos I have been intending to make, including one showing you some Perfect Keto goodies, so look out for that coming soon. In the meantime, the Perfect Keto peeps have kindly given me a discount code for you to use to get 15% off. Use code KETOWOMAN15 on your purchase at perfectketo.com. I'll also put a link on my links page at links.ketowomanpodcast.com and in the show notes as usual. Welcome, Chris, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Well, it's nice to see you. We've been chatting via email for a couple of weeks now, so it's good to see you in person.
Yeah, good to see you too. I'm excited to chat some keto today.
Absolutely. So why don't you kick off by telling the listeners a bit about you and how you got into doing what you do now?
Yeah, so my name is Chris Irvin, and I run the Ketologist page on social media and on my website. And I am the education manager for Perfect Keto. So to give a quick little backstory about how I got here, I went to my undergrad school and studied biology and exercise science. And at the time, I had a really big emphasis on exercise. I was, you know, I cared a lot more about that than I did nutrition. And then when I graduated from my undergrad, I spent a year doing exercise performance training. So I was training like youth athletes, collegiate athletes, just, you know, trying to improve their athletic performance for various sports. And during that time, I got a lot more into nutrition and especially nutrition science. So I decided to go back to grad school to get my master's in nutrition science. And I first came across the keto diet about 2 months before I went to grad school. So this would have been back in 2015. I went to a conference down in Tampa, Florida, and at the conference was Dr. DiAgostino and Dr. Volek, who at the time I had no idea who they were. Didn't know that I was looking at like two of the guys that are on like the Mount Rushmore of keto scientists. Yeah. And I also didn't know that I was looking at two guys that were going to, you know, had already done so much work on keto, but we're going to continue to progress this field forward so much. But when I first learned about keto at that time, I really only saw the diet as a weight loss diet. So I didn't really give it a try for myself. I more of just passed the information along to anybody I knew who I thought could use it for weight loss. Fast forward probably 4 to 5 months, I started grad school, and first nutrition class that I started, we talked about keto. We talked about a lot of the different applications of keto, and I just kind of decided, you know, hey, I think there's some more application here. I want to get into studying it. So I better try it myself. So I just jumped in, had no idea
That's
what I
was... interesting. I'm just going to stop you there and go back a little bit. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it was something you discussed at school. That's not common.
No, it's not at all.
And depending on what kind of light it was being discussed, because oftentimes you hear if it is being discussed, it's being discussed in a negative way.
Yeah.
So perhaps you could just talk a little bit about that, because that immediately sparked my interest.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a great thing to bring up, because I had taken nutrition courses in my undergrad, and I had even watched the movie First Do No Harm that, you know, highlighted Charlie and his story and everything, but still had never heard of the ketogenic diet. It was never talked about during that time. And then in grad school, I just had a professor who was a big proponent of it. And I was in Tampa, Florida, which, you know, at the time was kind of turning into a little bit of a hub for keto stuff, because that's where Dr. DiAgostino's lab is at USF. I was at University of Tampa, but there were a lot of studies that were coming out a couple of years before I started there that were looking at keto, especially for sports performance. So they had already kind of known a little bit that keto was something that was great. There was a lot of research out there that was kind of still uncovered. So they were already promoting it. And in that first class, they were talking a lot about sports performance. So I had no introduction yet to the therapeutic side of keto yet. Everything at the time was like endurance performance and trying to debunk some of the stuff about like muscle building on keto, which, you know, back then we weren't really sure if you could do it. And it was really the first class that we chatted about that, because it was kind of a point of emphasis in that lab that I was working at. So, but to your point, yeah, not something that gets covered very commonly in school. If you are in a class that actually talks about nutrition, usually you're getting the standard stuff that's telling you need to have carbohydrates. Especially in a sports nutrition class, it'd be very rare to actually hear somebody say that you didn't need carbohydrates.
Exactly. That's why it jumped out to me.
Yeah, especially back in 2015 too, because, you know, keto wasn't really booming yet as it is now. So back then it was even more uncommon to have something like that.
Yeah. So fortunate for you, I guess, like you say, possibly because of the environment you were in and who was operating in the area.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely something that I fell into. It wasn't the reason why I went to school there. I wasn't into the keto research yet at the time. I had just chosen that school because they were, at the time I was really into like the science of like muscle building and the nutrition behind muscle building. And they were doing a lot of research there at that lab. So that was kind of one of the things that really brought me down there. And then keto was what really made me stay and kind of progressed me forward. So I jumped into it.
That's really interesting to think about that crossroads, mm-hmm. or that fork in the road you had at that point. If you'd have been anywhere else, mm-hmm. looking with the emphasis you had, you would have probably gone down a carb heavy route, I imagine.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what, before I went to grad school down in Tampa, I was between choosing University of Tampa and choosing Illinois State University, which is in Bloomington, Illinois. And I was going to do more of a kinesiology route there, and it was going to be much more focused on exercise, but there would have been nutrition classes in there, I'm sure, too. But I really doubt that I would have gotten any formal introduction into keto, and it probably would have been something that would have taken a lot longer for me to come. I think I would have come across it eventually because it's just out there now, but I don't think I would have been coming to it as early as I got to from going down to Tampa.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, sorry to have derailed you a
bit
there.
No, that's great. Carry on. Yeah, I think that's a great thing to point out because it's a testament to the fact that we need to ensure that we are giving better nutrition training in college, because I got really lucky that I came across it. And, you know, I feel like I've made a big change in my health and other people's health from coming across it. And if more people that were taking these classes were, you know, had the opportunity to learn about keto, I think we could be making a bigger difference. So I think that's a great thing to bring up.
Exactly. At least having it there as an option.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us who have reaped so many benefits of it would like it to be the mainstream norm.
Right.
But realistically speaking, just having it there as an option, mm-hmm. giving people that information, you know, that would be enough.
Yeah, there's still so many people that don't even know about it. I think a lot of times, like for a lot of us who are in the keto community, we think that it's so big and everybody knows about it. And then I go somewhere where I'm talking to people that are outside of kind of my circle, and I realize like, wow, we have so much work to do. There's still so many people that have no idea, or if they do know something, they don't have the correct information, which is good. You know, that's that means that we have a lot more work to do, and I like working in this field. So I think that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
Yeah. So to kind of keep going on that, I started the keto diet myself. I made a bunch of mistakes as I was going. I was, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of resources out there yet. So I was just kind of making it up as I was going, trying to figure it out. Later that semester, I started working in the actual lab doing research. And I started doing research with collegiate athletes and college kids who were just, you know, very well trained. So it was a very cool population to study because it was people who were pretty adapted to exercise. And we were using the ketogenic diet in them to test a lot of different things. We were testing exogenous ketones. We were testing things like HIIT training versus steady state cardio for keto adaptation. We were testing like performance measures like strength and power on keto. So it was really cool because I got a chance to see that in such a well-trained population, which is sometimes rare for research. A lot of times you might be getting subjects who are completely untrained, which is, you know, still a good population to study, but coming from a sports background, and I played sports in college and everything, it was something that I was really grateful for. So after doing that for about 4 or 5 months, I went home for, you know, Christmas break that first semester, and I picked up the book Tripping Over the Truth by Travis Christofferson, which I'm sure a lot of people on this podcast have heard of. If you haven't read it, it's a really incredible account of like a lot of the keto for a lot of metabolic disorders, especially cancer. And that book, like I read it in like 2 days. I just couldn't put it down when I picked it up. And it was my first introduction into this therapeutic side of keto. At the time, I had really thought that, you know, keto was either weight loss or sports performance, but I didn't see it as this potential for cancer and Alzheimer's and diabetes and all these things. So when I came back that semester, I really shifted my focus, and I spent like 2 or 3 months just like really diving into cancer research. I was, you know, just such a big fan of the work of like Thomas Seyfried and Dr. Poff, Angela Poff, and everybody out there who was putting out such great stuff. And, you know, after doing like 2 or 3 months of just researching cancer for like 4 or 5 hours a day, I stumbled across Dr. Angela Poff's dissertation, which was using like ketones and hyperbaric oxygen therapy and the ketogenic diet for cancer in rats. You know, after stumbling across that, I realized that Dr. Poff was not only in Tampa, but she was actually a guest professor at the University of Tampa, and I had no idea at the time. So I immediately just reached out to her and said, hey, I would love to volunteer in the lab. If there's anything that I can do to come in and help, it'd be really cool to get to experience what you guys are doing. She took me in right away, and they were looking for some help there. So I got to spend the rest of my grad school doing just helping with a lot of the therapeutic research that they were doing in mice and rats, which was really cool because one, I got to learn from the top minds in the keto space. I mean, the people that were in there, the doctors, were the smartest people that I've ever been around, and they, you know, pushed me every day to get better. And by the end of it, I kind of was at this crossroads where I was like, you know, I'd planned this whole time to get my PhD. I want to go into this. But after spending some time in the lab, I started to realize how I thought I was going to burn out and I wasn't going to maybe enjoy doing that long term. So I kind of came to this crossroad road where I had to figure out really where I wanted to go. I knew that I was, you know, such a big fan of keto and I really liked the researching it and I really liked the educational standpoint of things. So I kind of decided that I kind of saw this gap in everything where I was in the lab and I was reading all these research papers and I was seeing how much work these scientists were doing. And I was really discouraged when I was just realizing how many people didn't have access to this information. So there's all these, you know, so much great research on, like I said, Alzheimer's and diabetes, cancer, and now stuff like PCO, like all these things that people are really suffering from and don't feel like they have options for. And this research is there. These scientists are doing this incredible work, but it's either locked away in a journal somewhere that people don't have access to, or it was just difficult for some people to understand it. So that's kind of where I started the Ketologist. And I started with like these educational infographics to just try to make keto much more simple for them and started, you know, pushing out information to people. And over the course of doing that for a couple of years, I started to see that there's always been this clear separation between industry and academics where people really like to keep them separated. And for good reason too, because industry can really convolute research. It can get in there and, you know, people have agendas and things like that. But I think if done well, industry can be a really great way to complement what's going on in academics because it can help reach the general population and push, you know, push this diet out to more people and even make this diet easier for people when you start seeing you know, all these companies that have products out, there's obviously some good ones and some bad ones, but a lot of times these products help people do keto. So I kind of saw that there was this opportunity to maybe take the skill sets that I had learned and go over to the industry side and see if I could bring good research and academics and academic background over to that. So that's where I stumbled into Perfect Keto. I'd actually been using Perfect Keto products since grad school. I started testing a lot of exogenous ketones in grad school, but at the time I was doing like raw ketone salts with Mio, which was just not tasty. A very great tasting thing. So Perfect Keto came around and, you know, this was before there were a lot of companies that were selling exogenous ketones. And when Perfect Keto came around, I remember trying it and just being like, oh, this is a game changer. This actually tastes pretty good, which I saw as an opportunity to actually get this product in the hands of people because I felt that from the research I had done that exogenous ketones were beneficial. So I had been a big fan of Perfect Keto for a few years. And then there was an opportunity for me to come on as the education manager here. So that's what I'm doing now. So what that looks like is I do a lot of the education for our marketing team and for our, you know, blogs and everything like that to make sure that everything that we say is backed up by science, make sure that we're not making any claims that aren't supported by research, and just putting together a lot of these educational materials. And then actually, we just finished up, me and Dr. Gustin, who's the founder of Perfect Keto, we just finished up writing our first book, which is going to be coming out next month. So that was kind of another big project that I've been working on.
Fantastic.
So yeah, so that's kind of everything to date. And here we are.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to go on to talk a bit about exogenous ketones.
All right.
People who listen to the podcast will know I've been challenging my existing belief set a bit with some conversations I've had recently. Mm-hmm. So when your email dropped into my inbox, I thought it would be a good opportunity to talk about it a bit more.
Yeah.
I just want to roll back a bit to a couple of things you were talking about before. Mm-hmm. Some of the experiments you were doing and you were working on that you mentioned in the lab, the performance and then also the cancer research. I'd just be interested to hear a little bit more about that. So the experiments you were doing with the athletes, mm-hmm. presumably, was that comparing high carb with keto? How were the experiments set up and what kind of results were you finding?
Yeah, so with the performance research, what we would do is, and we had a blend of some of them were athletes, like we would get kids from the basketball team, soccer team, baseball team coming in. But then some of them were just students who were working out on an, you know, daily basis, people who were in really good shape. And what we would do is we would bring them in and we would I would put everybody through a keto education course so that we could make sure that everybody was following a very similar diet. We wanted to make sure that people were doing the diet the right way because, you know, obviously you can control what happens when they come into the lab, but you can't control what happens the other 20 hours, 22 hours of the day. So that was kind of step one, was bringing everybody in and kind of giving these mini courses and talking about keto. And then what we would do is we would split up the groups between people just staying on their habitual diet. So we weren't necessarily switching them to a high carb diet, but rather just keeping them on the diet that they were consuming, which for most people, especially college kids, is a high carb diet. And then we would, you know, put the other group on keto. So for the one study that we did, we were just had them exercising for the duration of the study. So we gave them training program to follow, and it was resistance training, and we tracked their volume to see, you know, how their volume was able to keep up as they went through keto adaptation, as they got a little more adapted to the diet, and then as they were completely fat adapted. And then, you know, at the beginning of the test, we measured things like power, strength, and body composition, and then we measured again at the end of the study. So that was a really cool study that we found some really, really great stuff. And we saw that these students improved all of their performance measures. There were some dips in performance when they first started the diet, of course, as there usually is, which is kind of a big testament to the reason why you need to have longer duration studies when you're looking at athletic performance. It's inevitable that you're going to be seeing some dips in performance when you start keto. You know, you get that little bit of keto flu and things like that.
Yeah, I've heard that with people I've spoken to before, and actually that transition stage can take quite a long time.
Yeah.
I remember speaking to someone who was really into CrossFit and was a CrossFit trainer herself, and she said it took about 3 months before she actually got back to where she was before.
Yeah.
And then it started to improve, and it was only because her trainer, who was helping her through it, said, "You just got to keep pushing through it." She felt that, you know, she might well have given up if it hadn't been for that keep going, because that's quite a long time.
Yeah, it really is. And especially when you start speaking about like athletes who are like, there's a big difference between average Joes like myself who are just working out. Like when I started doing keto, I didn't really see much of a dip in my performance because I wasn't this athlete that was performing at a very high level. So for people out there who are, you know, big CrossFitters and they're accustomed to like breaking PRs all the time and they have these numbers that they're always going for, it's more common for them to see these decrements in performance, which can somewhat be combated for a lot of people. I think most people who are experiencing that thing, it's a result of something like electrolyte deficiency, dehydration. But there's also this component of like your body does have to adjust to using a different fuel source, and that can take some time, especially for somebody who has like a CrossFit athlete, for instance. They're probably coming from a pretty high carbohydrate diet, and probably have been doing that for a long time. So that's a pretty big adjustment for them to do. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that we need to give time for that. But, you know, that's one of the reasons why we see in research, you'll see a lot of people point to these studies that say, oh, you know, keto or low carb dieting is bad for performance. And then you look at the study that they're citing and it's a 7-day study.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, it's like, have you done keto before? Did you feel great your first week? Do you think your performance measures would go up? I mean, you know, definitely not. So not something we should be surprised about.
Yeah, I can understand why if somebody, especially if their livelihood relies upon their performance, they're going to be a bit reluctant to do something that is going to impede that, even if it's just for the short term.
Yeah.
They have to be really confident that the result at the other end is going to be an improvement on where they are now.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, so that was one of the big studies I did. And then another really interesting study that we looked at while I was there was we took a lot of the people from that same group. Actually, no, I take that back. We did not take people from the same group because we wanted new keto dieters for this one. And we measured the effects of high-intensity interval training on a Wingate bike versus steady-state cardio for keto adaptation. So not that we can really measure keto adaptation yet. You know, I think in the future where we will be able to test this, but we really can't test for that. It's more of a subjective thing. But what we were assuming was that if we could induce some sort of exercise that would stimulate greater ketone production, then this would probably lead to better like upregulation of MCT transporters. And then that would allow for people to get adapted to the diet a little bit better.
This is something that you're saying that you're introducing at the same time. So it's not something that they were accustomed to. So you've got a group starting keto and using the high intensity, and then you've got another group starting keto and using the cardio route.
When you say not accustomed to the training, kind of hard to say, because were they accustomed to doing high intensity interval training on a Wingate bike? No, most of them had never done that before. But a lot of these people were very well trained. They were probably accustomed to doing exercise that would be similar, you know, have similar mm-hmm. effects on the body, like just different cardio work that they may have been doing. So these weren't like completely untrained people that were coming in and like, you know, super exhausted because they couldn't handle what we were throwing at them, which was kind of fun, to be honest, because we were really able to push them, which when you talk about like high intensity interval training, that's really the purpose, is that you're trying to really push that threshold. And we were able to do that with them, which was really fun. And we did actually find in that study that the high intensity interval training did lead to more ketone production. Just kind of something to look at. I think it's one of those things I typically will recommend when people start keto, that it's good to try to get some higher intensity exercise in. Obviously, that's a relevant thing. Not everybody can train at the same intensity. Like, what's high intensity for me is going to be a lot different for somebody that's out there. But I think pushing your body a little bit can be good when you're adapting to the diet. But you know, obviously we know that you're not always going to feel the best when you're starting. So you have to do that within your own means, which is going to be different for everybody.
There have been a lot of studies in general, haven't there, showing the benefits of high intensity mm-hmm. exercise versus just standard
yeah.
cardio. Perhaps you could just spell out the difference. I mean, most people do know the difference, but mm-hmm. you mentioned it just there. You have to reach a certain level of intensity for that, even though it's a very short period of time, isn't it?
Yeah.
There is a certain level that you have to reach, and that is different from everybody. But mm-hmm. how would we know? How would I know, for example, what level I had to reach to be effectively doing high intensity training?
Yeah, so there's two ways I think that you can look at that, because I think that's a really good question. There's two ways you can look at it. There's a scientific way to do it, and then there's just a more practical way to do it.
Feeling like you're about to die way.
Right, right. So like for somebody who is new to exercise, you've haven't really done this before, I think that the perception of intensity is probably good enough for those people. Like, you know, be honest with yourself, push yourself. And then as you, you know, start making adaptations to training at that higher intensity, then you can start measuring things like heart rate. So I think heart rate is a really big thing to look at. You know, you're trying to basically get your heart rate up to pretty close to your max for a certain period of time. And then you're trying to allow it to recover back down before you get after it again. So traditionally, if we look at like what people are doing with high intensity interval training in research, they're usually doing it on a Wingate bike, where it's not like high intensity, like what you see people doing at the gym, where they're doing, you know, 10 sets of sprints on the treadmill and getting off. Like if you're doing a Wingate, it's pretty tough to get back on and do it again. What happens for those people who don't know on a Wingate is you start pedaling the bike and it gets up to a certain RPM, and then it drops a load of weight. Basically that you feel that weight and that you're fighting against it. So you're going really fast and now you're hitting this resistance. And I mean, even doing it for like 10 seconds is extremely difficult. You're out of breath. Your heart rate goes through the roof. Your legs feel like they're just going to burn and fall off. Like it's a very tough thing.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. Oh, we used to have a blast with it. I mean, we used to try these. We used to do like drop sets, and we would try to see how many rounds we could go with, you know, and we did so many fun things in there. But obviously, this isn't something that the general population or people who aren't working in a lab need to be focusing on. I think for a lot of people, it could be even as simple as like, hey, I'm going on a walk and then I'm going to sprint for, you know, 10 to 15 seconds and then I'm going to go back to walking. Or I'm going to, you know, do hills where I'm going to run up a hill and then kind of walk down the hill and then run up a hill, walk down the hill. I think those are more practical ways to do it, where you're pushing your body outside of its comfort zone. You know, it's not the same as going in and picking up weights. It's not the same as jogging on the treadmill. You know, you're pushing that threshold a little bit more, but it doesn't have to be the super scientific approach where we have to be measuring everything and making sure that you're getting to the certain threshold. I think that's more for people who are maybe at the higher end of their athletic training, or maybe doing it for their primary goal is improving performance. That's probably where that comes into play.
It's getting out of breath, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you can walk and talk and carry out a normal conversation, you're not pushing yourself too much.
Yeah.
If you're finding that you can't speak mm-hmm. and you're getting out of breath, then that means you're just pushing your body a bit harder. I remember having this conversation with my mother and saying, she lives down in Worthing by the sea and she has the South Downs behind her. And I went on a walk when I was there, and you're marching up that hill and you get out of breath, but you can, and you can feel your heart pounding, but you can feel that that's good for you. And she said, well, I don't like to get out of breath when I'm going for a walk. Well, yeah, but that it's a good thing to do that. Not all the time, but just as you were saying, to have those little bursts of energy where you get out of breath. That's what just, that's the whole point, isn't it, of the intensity.
Yeah. And it's like, we know that chronic stress is obviously not a good thing. We don't want our body to always be in this state of stress, but acute stress can be great. And it's something that can really help our body adapt. Even for me, like, because I was working in a lab and stuff like that, I was really able to, I had access to this equipment to use it a lot. And I noticed a really big difference in, you know, like basketball is my cardio activity of choice. I play that several times a week. And I've noticed a really big difference in the way that I can get up to, I can push it, but I can also recover very quickly. Like my heart rate variability has improved a lot from being able to do that type of training. So the stress that you put on your body when you're doing that, when you're pushing it just a little bit, is great. Now, I think a lot of people are overdoing it. I hear a lot of times, I had somebody just the other day reach out to me on Instagram, and they were saying that they were doing high intensity interval training like 5 times a week or something like that. And you know, my two thoughts to that was like, one, if you're able to do it 5 times a week, you're probably not pushing it as much as you should be, or your recovery is just insane and you're kind of a freak with that. But two is that, like, even if you are able to get it up to that high intensity 5 days a week, that's a stress that your body doesn't need. And you're probably doing a lot more harm than good with that. With this type of training, it's not something where more is necessarily better. I think it's more about getting the most out of it when you do it, when you do do it.
It sounds, when you were talking about recovery there, that is something that I hear coming up time and time again when I've spoken to athletes, that that's one of the differences they found after keto, that their recovery is much better.
You know,
marathon runners, the different people I've spoken to, that's the big thing that they've noticed.
Yeah. And I think the reason why that is, and well, I think that there's several reasons for it, but you know, when you're talking about exercise and you're talking about your body having a huge energy demand during that, when you're burning fat and ketones, it's creating a lot less of an inflammatory response compared to when you're burning glucose. So, you know, if you're somebody who you're a high carb athlete and you're taking a lot of like sugary gels and all of these things before you're exercising, that's creating a lot of reactive oxygen species. When you're burning through that, it's a lot more stress on your cells. Eventually, it's going to be, you know, pretty damaging to like your mitochondria and stuff. But we know that when you're burning ketones and fat, it's it creates a lot less reactive oxygen species. So I think that that's kind of a big thing, is you're not getting as much of this inflammation as response to your exercise. And also, we kind of know that when you're using ketones and fat, that glucose can kind of actually be shuttled down different pathways that allow for more antioxidant production. So you may even be producing these things that can help combat any inflammation that you may be getting from exercise. So I think that's one of the big reasons why people notice that. And admittedly, I noticed the same thing too. I mean, I remember I played basketball in college, and I remember, you know, as a 21, 22-year-old being so sore after games. And obviously, I was playing at a little bit higher intensity, but now I can play 3-4 times a week and I feel like my recovery is incredible. And I'm, you know, I'm 27 now. So the way that we look at things, we should think that I probably shouldn't be getting better with age. I should probably be going the other way. So I think that's kind of a big testament to keto.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
What about the research you were doing in the cancer lab?
Some of that stuff I can't dive into too much, but I can talk about a little bit of the things that I was doing. So my time there, I was getting accustomed to what it was like to like work with rats and what it was like to work with animals. So, you know, seeing what it was like to do like an oral gavage, which is basically being able to administer ketones or MCTs or anything like that to the rat by, you know, getting it down into their system, into their digestive system. So I spent a lot of time practicing that, and then spent a lot of time like practicing with, you know, what it was like to do sutures on the rats and like stitch them up and put them through different scans and measure different measures with them when we were doing tests. And then I got to help out with a couple studies as well. It's a tough job in there. I have to give a big kudos to the people who are doing it, because one, there's a huge need for it. I think a lot of people who, you know, we like to discredit animal research because it's not human research, which admittedly we can't take what we find in animal research and directly apply it to, you know, humans. But it's such an important thing because it's what lays the foundation, and it's what we can do in the meantime while we're trying to, you know, improve our guidelines and get this research into more humans. It's kind of the first step that we have to have. And it really is a little bit of the dirty work. Like it's not the thing that most people want to do. I mean, you know, not everybody wants to spend time in a lab with rats, especially depending on which type you're working with. Some of them can be pretty mean. And I had a couple experiences with that too. Huge kudos to the people who are doing it because it's not an easy thing to do. It's a lot of hard work. And the people who I was working with in that lab, I mean, the amount of hours that they were putting in and the care and the attention to detail that these people had was incredible. And super fortunate to be able to have learned from them.
Absolutely. And I mean, just the fact that you're experimenting on animals is, well, it can't be an easy thing to do day in, day out.
You know, it's definitely not. Luckily, we weren't doing anything that was, you know, we weren't doing anything crazy, and we weren't doing, like, you know, there's some research out there. I think the one research that I can't imagine doing is when you look at a lot of the rat research on concussions and how they have to like give these animal concussions and stuff like that. Like that's stuff that I think can be pretty brutal. But luckily we weren't having to do things that were too bad like that, you know, and knowing that what we were doing was also like really beneficial for the population. Like we were doing research that was really progressing things forward. And I think that's what, you know, makes it a little bit easier. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that you started eating ketogenically. You did mention that you made a lot of mistakes when you started.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know what those are, because I think people are always worried about doing things wrong. And in my mind, doing things wrong is just kind of part of the learning process. But
yeah,
I'd be interested to know what kind of things you did that you feel were the wrong things to do.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you too. I think that it's better. Too many people are waiting until they have all of the information to start something like improving their diet.
Yeah, get all your ducks in a row before you start. But to be honest, you can wait forever if you're going to do that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you're never going to know everything. I mean, I research keto every day for hours and I still don't know everything about it. So if I was going to wait till I knew everything, I still wouldn't have started it. But I think the three things that really come to mind that I made big mistakes of is I had no idea about electrolyte replenishment and like how common dehydration was on keto. So that was a really big problem for me. And when I first started, I remember very clearly on my third day, because I was also exercising a lot and I'm somebody who has a high sweat rate. I had actually just moved to Florida, so I was just getting used to like the heat and humidity in the summer down there. And I remember on my third day, I had like a wave of depression almost, where I was like sitting down there and, you know, I was new to the area, so I didn't really have like a whole lot of friends yet or anything. And I was like, man, what am I doing down here? I have no idea like where I'm going with my career. I'm like not happy. Like I just moved away from home. What's going on? And I think a lot of that was just like my electrolytes were out of whack. I was probably really magnesium deficient. You know, sodium was probably all out of whack. And I was cramping up. I remember that too. Like I, brain fog, like all this stuff. And at the time, a lot of people would just say, oh, that's just keto flu. It's just something that you have, like you have it for a couple of weeks and it gets better. So I just kind of dealt with it. And then I started digging into the research more and learning what happens when your insulin levels lower. And then I was like, oh, actually this is something that we can combat. And, you know, 95% of keto flu symptoms, I actually think that you can avoid them if you kind of hack it the right way. So that was the first one. And then, having a really big emphasis on fat, I think was probably too much for me. I think that when you first start keto, consuming more dietary fat can be beneficial because you're getting accustomed to burning your stored body fat and producing and utilizing ketones. But I was like putting oil on everything, putting butter on everything, which, you know, that's kind of the story for most people when they start keto. I was really falling victim to this. You have to have the high fat part for it to be ketogenic, and probably overdoing it in that sense. So that was a big one. And then the third one was not eating enough protein. I was, had definitely fallen victim to that thought that if you have too much protein, it's going to be harmful to your state of ketosis. And if you go over 20 to 25%, you're going to experience a lot of side effects. You're going to have, you know, high blood sugar, gluconeogenesis, all of that stuff. And, you know, at the time I was still just getting into nutrition research and biochemistry and cell biology. So I hadn't really fully understood a lot of those processes yet. So I was keeping my protein very low. And I remember at some point in my first year, I was playing a lot of basketball. And so I was obviously doing a lot of cardio. I was working out. And I remember just like looking in the mirror and being like, man, I look pretty skinny. Just like, I felt like I really lost a lot of muscle mass. And, you know, I was kind of under this impression that, like, you know, they say that ketones will prevent you from losing muscle. So as long as I have ketones, I should be good to go. But I really felt and saw that I was losing muscle, and I actually did a DEXA scan and I was losing muscle. So, that was kind of the big thing where I was like, wow, I really need to. I think the realization that I got from that was that keto is not a one size fits all approach. We really have to adjust it based on who we are, what we're doing, what our training's like. And once I made that realization.
Absolutely. I was just about to say that, that the things you're talking about, I think the electrolytes is probably something that just applies to everybody.
Yeah.
End of. But when it comes to particularly that fat protein ratio, that's very different depending who you are, what your goals are, what your metabolism is like. You know, I've got someone in my mind who has been struggling to lose weight, and she is in that morbidly obese category. And the only thing that has worked for her, and I'm not talking about keeping protein too low, but keeping the fat up to a certain rate, having actually a 2-to-1 fat to protein ratio, is the only thing that is working for her.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's fascinating how it is completely different for different people. And I think you're right in saying that they are important things to focus on, but that there isn't this one size fits all. It's finding out what the ratio is that works best for you.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point. I mean, I did some coaching when I first got into keto. I was helping, you know, a lot of people were coming to me saying they wanted help with keto. And when people would come to these like weight loss plateaus, you know, first thing I would do is look at like their diet, and I would look at, you know, are you eating pro-inflammatory foods? How's your food quality? How's your stress? Like I would kind of weigh those things out first. And then we would take a look at macronutrients, and there would be some people where drastically lowering their dietary fat and increasing their protein would bust them through that plateau. And then for somebody else, it would be the exact opposite. It would be increase their dietary fat and lower their protein, and they would see benefits. So it really is dependent. And I think an important thing to remember with that too is that when you're doing keto, you are repairing your metabolism, you're repairing your body altogether. So what works for you when you first start is might be different from what works for you later on. So, you know, for like I said at the beginning, for most people, I think that when you start keto, the higher fat approach tends to work pretty well. But as you start getting, you know, more accustomed to that, especially if you have a higher body fat percentage, I've noticed a lot that those people can actually lower that fat a little bit, you know, making sure that they don't go too heavy into a calorie deficit, because I think too many people are going too low on their calories. But they can lower that a little bit more, and they can increase their protein, and they can really see a lot of benefits in their body composition. So I think that a lot of times we kind of fall into this, well, it worked for me at this point in my journey, so it must work for me all the time. And that's just not the case, because your body is so dynamic and it changes. And, you know, you're talking about a completely different metabolic landscape when you're fat adapted compared to before you were fat adapted. So I think that's the other thing, is just knowing that like at different times you may benefit from different approaches.
Absolutely. So it's not only not a one size fits all, and what has worked perfectly for someone else isn't necessarily going to work perfectly for you. You need to find what works for you, but then you need to keep finding what works for you and keep reassessing it as you go.
And even too, just, you know, adjusting it for your goals too. So like, you know, for me, I know that intermittent fasting is really, really great for me for improving like my cognitive function. So like before this podcast, I'm in Texas right now. So it's 10 a.m. here. I'm fasted for this because I know that when I'm fasted and I have some MCTs or exogenous ketones before something like this, my brain works a lot better. But I also know that I don't recover as well from the gym if I'm always doing intermittent fasting. So like I did intermittent fasting for basically a year, where it was like every day I was doing like 16 to 18 hour fasts. And I was kind of experiencing a little bit of muscle loss. My recovery wasn't as good. My energy was down. I was too heavily calorie restricted. So I kind of had to look at this and say, okay, this is a strategy that I use when I'm trying to achieve a certain thing, but it's not necessarily something that I should be using all of the time. So I think that's another important thing to realize too, is that, you know, the traditional way, I think the better way to look at it is like the traditional way that keto is followed when you start talking about this 20 to 25% of your calories from protein and 70 to 75% of your fat. That was what was invented when we were trying to treat epilepsy in the 20s. That's a completely different use case than why a lot of us might be following it, whether it's treating a condition or losing weight or improving body composition, improving brain function, whatever it is that you're going for. So that, you know, it's so important to figure out what works best for you and kind of learn what tools you can have in your tool belt whenever you're trying to achieve a certain goal.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share, and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Confucius, and it's something I tell myself quite a lot, especially when I'm struggling and have a tendency to want to beat myself over the head with a heavy object for not getting the things done I want to get done. It was also something I reminded myself of when the weight loss was frustratingly slow or even non-existent. It does not matter how slowly you go, as long as you do not stop. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.